Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. The time is 1:37 p.m. We're in Butchovich, room 205 of the nation's most beautiful and sunny capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Tuesday, February 17th, 2026. Members present are Senator Tobin, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senators Stedman and Rauscher are excused. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Transportation. I would like you all to please turn off or silence your cell phones and join with me in extending a warm Senate Transportation Committee welcome to our recording secretary, Heather Ramseth, and our LAO moderator, Doug Bridges. Today, we are discussing the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities response to Typhoon Halong. Here from the department today, we have Deputy Commissioner Ms. Catherine Keith, Merle Cena, and Amber Chumpert. Welcome all to Senate Transportation. If you could please join us at the table, we would be delighted to have you. Please begin.
All right, excellent. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Catherine Keith, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. With me is Merle Cena. He's a project engineer with Central Region Construction. And in this capacity, he's been leading on-the-ground Bethel operations for the past 5 or 6 months now. I also have Amber Chumpert, our safety systems manager statewide for the department. And in this capacity, she's been the deputy incident command for this response. We did want to start out by sharing a few videos with everybody. And the reasoning for this is that this disaster, just because of how widespread Typhoon Halong and the West Coast storm was.
In October 2025,
Pictures worth 1,000 words, and I think it would do a better job portraying conditions. This first video is going to cover the infrastructure losses and community impacts across the event. Want to highlight we have our communications team representative, Gabe Strong, in the back, who had prepared these videos. These are done in-house with our resources.
In October 2025, when the West Coast storm and Typhoon Halong struck, under Governor Dunleavy's disaster declaration and direction, Alaska's Department of Transportation and Public Facilities activated its incident command system and mobilized a coordinated statewide response. The scale of infrastructure loss across Western Alaska was immediate and severe. More than 50 communities were impacted across hundreds of miles of coastline and river systems. Over 800 homes were severely damaged. More than 100 were destroyed. More than 200 were displaced from their foundations, some carried over a mile by floodwaters. Entire housing clusters shifted. Transportation infrastructure was heavily affected. More than 12 miles of board roads were destroyed or severely damaged. Over a mile of road was washed out. 5 airports sustained damage, interrupting the primary access lifeline for communities not connected to the road system. Utility systems experienced systemic failure. Miles of water and sewer lines were washed away. Power distribution infrastructure was compromised. Water treatment plants froze or lost functionality. Fuel and water storage tanks were contaminated. 15 schools were damaged. Cemeteries were disturbed by floodwaters. This was not isolated damage. It was system-wide disruption to housing, transportation, utilities, and public health infrastructure. More than 250 Department of Transportation and Public Facilities employees operated under an incident command structure, integrating logistics, engineering, planning, finance, procurement, and field operations. Damage assessments were completed in partnership with local residents using drone imagery and ground verification. All impacted runways were inspected, cleared, repaired, and returned to operational status within a week, restoring food, fuel, medical evacuation, and emergency access. Since October, staff and contractors have mobilized into more than 30 communities to conduct emergency stabilization and repair work. However, blizzards and freezing rain continue to destabilize already damaged systems. Families remain in partially stabilized homes. Power outages persist. Water and sewer systems remain under stress. Food and water access fluctuates. Recovery is not abstract. It is visible in helical piles being driven for boardwalk reconstruction. Homes lifted and reset onto foundations. Power poles reinstalled, utilities restored, and families returning to heated, structurally sound homes.
Okay, thank you. Now we're going to progress to the next video, which focuses on the damage assessment portion of this response, which immediately followed landfall of both a storm that hit more in the Kotzebue, Nome area, and then immediately after the YK Delta response.
Responding across remote Alaska requires speed, precision, and coordination across vast geography. Under Governor Dunleavy's disaster declaration and direction, Alaska's Department of Transportation and Public Facilities deployed advanced drone systems supported by geospatial mapping and an AI-supported assessment platform. Drone missions generated high-resolution orthomosaic imagery and geospatially referenced assessment data for 35 communities within 3 days. The technology enabled real-time analysis of board roads, airports, utility corridors, public facilities, and houses, reducing risk to field crews and improving prioritization. Rather than waiting weeks for manual documentation, engineers received mapped, organized, AI-supported datasets within days. These tools did not replace field expertise, they strengthened it. Advanced geospatial systems allowed us to quantify impacts, estimate material needs, and coordinate contractor mobilization faster and more accurately. Innovation in this response is about responsible decision-making, ensuring resources are directed where they are needed most.
Thank you. And this last video is about ongoing emergency repairs and operations, because this area-wide is still, the communities there are still in a state of emergency. And this will communicate a little bit why and provide some context for why we are now in the third extension of the disaster declaration.
Assessment was only the first step. The significant amount of required emergency repairs posed daunting logistics, given the short construction window and difficult transport options. Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities quickly mobilized 15 construction contractors, coordinated with 11 air carriers along with other transporters, and acquired materials from over 55 suppliers across the nation and into Canada. Among these contractors, there have been over 100 local hires, including more than 40 snow machine freight haulers. Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities Incident Support Base in Bethel continues to leverage available aircraft and surface transport to dispatch passengers, construction materials, food, water, and fuel. This multimodal system includes 11 types of fixed-wing aircraft, 8 helicopter types, barges, trucks, dozens of snow machines, and 8 piston bullies, coordinated to maximize the winter construction window. As of mid-February, more than 8 million pounds of materials have been delivered, with another 8 million pounds remaining. Field operations remain active in 14 communities, with temporary repairs completed in 15 others. While 4 miles of board roads have had emergency temporary repairs in order to begin operations, less than 1 mile of destroyed board road has been replaced. While Department of Transportation and Public Facilities contractors have completed stabilization work in 150 homes, they have over 200 still in progress, with more on deck to receive critical repairs. Repairs to schools, generators, power distribution, water treatment plants, and wastewater systems. Despite the many months since the typhoon, communities continue to face power outages that freeze water treatment plants. Sewer systems have failed under extreme conditions. Homes remain displaced and must be returned before spring thaw. Crews haul water jugs. Helicopters lift materials into constrained airstrips. Snow machine drivers move freight across long stretches of land and ice. Pile drivers work 24 hours to beat spring thaw. This critical repair effort remains active and time sensitive. The focus now is maintaining operational continuity through the remaining winter window before ground thaw limits heavy hauling and housing relocation. Residents are returning to help rebuild, regaining strength through community, one day at a time. A modern, resilient, and agile Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is working alongside local residents and agency partners, leveraging technology and stewarding public resources responsibly. In Alaska, recovery is about maintaining access, protecting essential services, and keeping communities connected. And we do it together, for all of Alaska.
Okay, thank you for enabling us showing those videos. It certainly helps depict some of the challenges, both with immediate impacts for the community, the residents, and then the emergency responders in the days and months following. This slide just goes through the event overview and system exposure, but we largely covered this all in the video, so I'm going to move forward unless there's any questions to talk about the timeline of response. And then as we move forward, you know, we'll focus a lot on any procedural steps that the department takes, our emergency authorities contracting, and happy to answer any questions as we go. Amber.
Good morning, or good afternoon. For the record, Amber Schumpert, Safety Systems Manager for Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So this timeline, it's not about individual dates. This shows the progression and discipline behind everything that we did. We activated our ICS team very early and coordinated through the State Emergency Operations Center as events unfolded. And while the State Emergency Operations Center and the National Guard were managing evacuations, our teams were deploying to create that common operating picture, which we'll discuss a little bit later. We had our UAS teams. We were collecting imagery. We were assessing impacts not only to the transportation infrastructure, but to the critical community infrastructure that they rely upon. And that early operational clarity, it informed decisions across all agencies for the entire response operations. And as conditions stabilized, we were able to move into stabilization efforts, such as beginning of November, the winterization efforts that helped to prevent further degradation of services and homes and preserve functionality heading into that season. And by January, permanent repairs began, such as our pile driving operations. So that marked the transition from emergency operations into a disciplined long-term recovery effort. So this, again, it's the movement through operational phases. As conditions changed, we moved through them and responded to them appropriately through the ICS structure. This wasn't an isolated effort. We did everything in coordination with the SCOC and our partners.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious. I've heard some folks, particularly in the Nome area, indicate that some of your folks who were there were reaching out, but their cell phones didn't work. So I'm just interested in what type of cell phone carriers you used for the 40 personnel that were deployed for those damage assessments. And do they have multiple phones for folks who may not necessarily have coverage under certain types of providers or carriers?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin. We did anticipate having communications challenges early on, so we equipped all of our responders with cell phones with AT&T FirstNet installed in them, as well as deployed them with Starlink capabilities for each team to ensure that they had multiple methods of communication, not only to the State Emergency Operations Center, to our own Emergency Operations Center, to each other, and the first responders as necessary.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And did you receive any feedback from community members that you were difficult to get a hold of? Because, again, I've had a few folks reach out to me and say that they weren't able to talk to personnel. Did anyone tell you or give you any feedback on that?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin, be happy to get more specific feedbacks. In the Nome area, we do have staff there locally that reside there. So it certainly communications were very challenging. We had GCI cell towers that were down. We have, using the Starlink, some capabilities where we can actually broadcast AT&T FirstNet, which allows anybody within a couple-mile radius on FirstNet to be able to respond to calls. And it took, in especially Kitnuck, up to 2 months to be able to restore cellular.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Just a reminder, if a new person speaks, if you could just let us know who you are, and that way for the record, we can all keep her on course here. I appreciate that. That's super helpful. A question for me, it didn't immediately come to mind that DOT would be the state agency that would be like tasked with responding to something like this. It wasn't like an intuitive thought. And maybe that just says more about my understanding of how our state government works than anything. But could you, for the public, just outline what it is that you are all responding to there to repair infrastructure-wise? Like, what are we as a state of Alaska responsible for? And then how do we restore that? Clearly, there is a great need and like this humanitarian need to do that. So how do all these pieces fit together? Meaning, how are we restoring and repairing infrastructure that hopefully could get folks back to normal as soon as possible? And then how do your teams all kind of deal with the humanitarian needs as well? Or is this kind of an all-in, like, fix everything thing? Do you just focus on state infrastructure first? How do you manage that and kind of keep things separate or together, or just do what needs to be done? How does that all work in this response?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Bjorkman. For the record, Catherine Keith. This has been a status quo for many years now, with the Department of Transportation taking the lead in the construction following a disaster. As the department is the construction arm of the state agencies, we have that contracting authority. It can then be delegated to other state agencies, but this is typical where we take that lead in getting out our emergency contracts, because we can leverage our resources within our contracting, within procurement, to get contractors out and be able to work with them and our construction staff in days or sometimes months following. So this is a normal way to go about it for us. But that being said, there are certainly some different infrastructure types that we tend to work on, which you wouldn't typically think within the purview of the DOT for transportation. For example, residential houses, electrical power plants, water treatment plants, these utilities, utility corridors, embankments where rivers have eroded and are threatening infrastructure. But when a state emergency disaster is declared, declared, and when a federal disaster is declared, there's a lot of exemptions that take place. At the state level, it's in statute when the governor has a disaster declaration that the state agencies then are empowered to go in and meet the need to help reduce risk to life and alleviate any emergency situations there for those in the area. So that is why in this event you see this, that we are stepping in to help with utilities and other such things. When that occurs, though, we are partnering with our other agencies, meaning we're on phone calls with ANTHC, the Yukon Health Corporation, working on what needs to be done and in what way. So
thank you. Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, this is Merle Senna. I'm a project engineer for the Alaska Department of Transportation, Central Region Construction Division. So as phase one for our field assessment and situational awareness, when we originally deployed after the disaster, we had roughly 16 drones that we were able to send out to various communities. As we were out in these various communities, we were able to provide immediate GPS quality information that we were able to send back to our Emergency Operations Center back in Anchorage, along with live streaming high-resolution footage, establishing reliable damage pictures in real time. Compiling this data and making it usable was valuable for our support team. And based off our historical data, where we've taken these drone flights before, we were able to get rough orders of magnitude, basically immediately showing what the pre-disaster conditions were, then immediately after the event. Once we had these quantities, we were able to then go and give all this information to our contractors and develop work plans and scopes of work so we could immediately get contractors deployed and actually start getting to work and rebuilding and sort of help these communities. And then, you know, typically our pre-construction process where, you know, planning, design, contracts, everything, sometimes that can take up to multiple years. Having all this really valuable data that we're able to get in roughly 3 days enabled us to condense this into roughly a less than 2 week period. So it was critical given when this disaster happened in the middle of October, knowing that we had the winter months coming up that we're gonna limit our operation capacity just due to natural limitations of doing work out in Western Alaska. Being able to have all this data in such a short timeline really enabled us to get as much work done as possible in the early part and set up our contractors who really stepped up to the plate and really helped us out a lot and really set them up and put them on a good foot to be able to staff accordingly, get equipment and materials out to these communities as fast as possible and provide us with good data to get rough, dial in our costs so we could, accurately forecast what our expenditures were going to be moving forward.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed here that you have 1,300 homes assessed. How many fish camps were also assessed?
Thank you. I'm sorry. Let me go back through the park chair. Through the chair. I'll be happy to provide that to the committee later today. I don't have that exact number in front of me right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the ongoing issues with the Nome area is how many fish camps were impacted. And we know that traditional FEMA funds don't necessarily cover the replacement of those critical pieces of infrastructure for our rural communities.
Yeah, and as a follow-up for the record, Catherine Keith, through the chair, Senator Tobin, one of the challenges with fish camps is that necessarily assessing them wasn't as viable. Many of them were just washed away. But the before and after imagery that we have does help us get a count of structures. The Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, though, in conjunction with FEMA, was very focused on those things and has a great inventory. When they get a chance to speak to that, they could answer that better than we could.
Mm-hmm. Right, for the record, Amber Schumpert. So this slide shows us how we integrated those digital capabilities that Merle discussed into our ICS structure. The drones, the orthomosaics, the side-by-side imagery that we had, that they were embedded in everything that we did. The images were geolocated, they were time-stamped, and they were tied to a specific structure or a specific piece of critical infrastructure. So that allowed us to move beyond just general damage assessments and get into verifiable damage assessments that FEMA would then accept. That helped pull together our common operating picture. So leadership, field teams, the State Emergency Operations Center, and FEMA all had access to the same information at the same time. That reduced duplication of efforts. It allowed for faster decision-making based on facts and not assumptions. And it allowed for remote assessments of critical infrastructure, such as bridges and sewer lagoons, from a distance instead of having to wait for in-person validation. That greatly increased our ability to give these communities aid. And where this became especially important was with our engagement with FEMA. For the first time, they accepted these digital records, and they accepted that the damage assessments conducted by Alaskans would not be then re-rated by an external validation team. And we were able to do that because we could sit down with them and show them the images. We could show them what it means when a heating fuel tank is detached from a home before winter starts, or what it means to have saturated insulation in subarctic conditions, what it means to have missing roof segments when freeze-up is just weeks away. So the imagery gave them the context, but the system we built gave this all credibility. So this is the before and after imagery comparison I mentioned. It's difficult to identify what's missing if you don't know what was there to begin with. So our GIS analysts were able to make these for us, where you could slide between pre-disaster imagery and post-disaster imagery. Picture's worth a thousand words. It painted clearly what was missing, what had been moved, what the damages were. Sitting in the State Emergency Operations Center, when the very first images of this from Kipnuk came in, it changed the game. The emotion in the room was palpable. Being able to show the entire system, the entire team, what actually the residents of Kipnuk were facing, it made it clear that this was a disaster unlike we had seen before. So if a partner called asking about a status of a runway or a lagoon, somebody in Anchorage could pull up this information and get them an answer. We didn't have to send teams out. Someone from Fairbanks or Anchorage could get that information for them. So this turned imagery into operational clarity.
And for the record, this is Merle Senna again. So one of the things that we were able to employ as part of this response effort, we were able to utilize on-ground sort of documentation along with aerial survey. So what we were able to do is link these two together, which was critical for, especially for a flood type disaster. If going just based strictly off an aerial photography, you may be able to look at just like a roof of the structure and think that it looked okay. But by actually going and having, like, we just had some of our employees just walking around communities with GoPro 360s, we were able to actually then look at all of the rest of the structure to see exactly where, like, the flood lines went up to on top of, through the structure. We were able to see if the foundation was damaged. We were able to see if the residents had, you know, shifted. We were able to see if there was, you know, flooring damage, you know, insulation damage, those types of things. If, you know, stairs had been removed, I'm going to say doghouse, but it's their on-site sort of septic house had been ripped off. So being able to tie that in real time to, as you're walking through a community, being able to, on the image, you'll see the red dot there that actually is able to geolocate where our employee was walking around, then actually show exactly what they're looking at. So being able to tie those two together was invaluable to us as far as for developing our initial assessments, being able to record these, you know, these damaged structures, then being able to develop a sort of system for identifying these houses to document our work, which residences and structures needed to be repaired, which ones we did not have to do any work on, and then as far as for tracking moving forward. Basically just creating basically a living as-built of our work from the start of the disaster and as we're going through over these next few months.
For the record, Amber Schumpert, to add to that, I cannot undersell how important those oblique angles are. As Merle mentioned, it's vital for FEMA to determine how high the water got. And without having modern weather systems and flood markers in these communities, without that sidelong angle of it, we wouldn't be able to prove to FEMA how high the water got, which would have directly impacted the damage rating, and they would have then downgraded from something from severe or destroyed to a lesser damage rating. And we do shout out, this took a lot of work for our employees. Eli here with us, having a GoPro 360 strapped to him as he ran through the villages, because sometimes we couldn't get someone to drive him around, and he made it happen. This is the common operating picture I mentioned. So after a storm like Halong, it's not just the storm that's the danger, it's uncertainty. A common operating picture, it's not a new concept, it's a core principle of emergency management. Leaders and responders need to operate from a shared real-time understanding of conditions so that decisions are grounded in facts and not assumptions. And what was different for us during Halong was that for the first time in Alaskan disaster history, we had a fully functioning common operating picture. So through our UAS imagery, the real-time dashboards, and our infrastructure mapping, we created that shared operational view that connected the field teams, the emergency operations centers, FEMA, and all of our associated partners. We were all working from the same information at the same time, and that reduces risk. It's not just risk to our responders, which is of utmost importance to us. Sending a lot of people into unknown conditions has a lot of risks in it. Being able to identify what those are and properly equip our responders before they go in, super important. It also allowed us to validate and communicate airfield conditions before we committed aircraft and crews into going in. Again, super important in the communities. Kipnuk had a significant structural crack in the airfield. We were able to identify this, get crews in to fix it, so that way air crew were confident and comfortable in landing there safely. And tied operational decisions directly to documentation and allowed for fiscal tracking in real time.
For the record, this is Merle Senna again. So for our immediate stabilization and our initial response or secondary response, we had over 250 DOT employees statewide that are working on this. It's been a huge effort for us. Right after the event happened, we had contractors throughout the state reaching out, which was amazing, reaching out, asking where they can help, letting us know where they had staff, where they had equipment, where they had materials in the area, and sort of working with us with helping develop a game plan on how we can better and faster go out there and provide immediate support and relief to these communities. One of the great things that we've been able to do as part of this effort is our contractors have been hiring a bunch of locals as part of their work. The slide there shows over 100. Our most recent updates, we have nearly 150 local hires across our various contractors that are out there working. It's been great. We've gotten a great response from the local hires in these communities, sort of having them feel like they're being part of the rebuilding process. Obviously, they're very proud people, just like all Alaskans are. They want to be part of rebuilding their homes and rebuilding their communities. And so it's been great to have them be part of this team effort. To date, we've moved over 8 million pounds of materials. We have roughly another 8 million to move here before the end of the winter. It's been fantastic. This is also as part of this process. This was the first time where our statewide incident command elevated to a level 4 disaster. So it's been a great test for our active incident command structure across all of our operations, logistics, planning, finance, and community engagement processes, especially with DOT being the lead agency throughout this entire effort. For the record, this is Merle Senna again. Speaking of our logistics and cargo operations, it's been very, it's been fun. It's been a very good engineering challenge throughout this disaster, I mean, it's not, I hate to say fun, because a lot of people have been very negatively impacted, and so there's a lot of gravity with that. But from an engineering standpoint and from a work standpoint, trying to do our best to go through all the logistical challenges that we've had to navigate as part of this disaster. This happened in the middle of October. So we were able to utilize barges in the very beginning portion of this effort. Roughly by about the end of October, water levels receded in the rivers, rivers started freezing, so then we had to move to more of an air-based transportation system for delivering all of our supplies and cargo to these various communities. As you can see from our average cost per pound, that's not exactly the most efficient way of going about it from a cost standpoint. Now, over the last roughly month and a half, we've been able to go to a more land-based logistics, materials and supplies, delivery system. Now that there's enough snow cover, now that the ground is frozen, very sensitive to all the critical environmental needs out there and critical environmental habitat out there. So now that the ground is frozen, there's enough snow, we've been able to utilize overland transport such as snow machines and snow-capped piston bullies for able to moving these large loads to these communities in need. And as you can see from the average cost per pound, these overland transport units are by far the most efficient way of going about getting the critical supplies out to these communities. There on the bottom left, you can see that is a caravan plane where every piece of that dimensional lumber and plywood has to be hand loaded out of those planes. And the caravans have been a critical part of our entire efforts, not just from dimensional lumber, whether that be insulation for residential repairs, plumbing supplies, water line, all those various needs, whether it's providing water to communities, whereas their water treatment plant goes down, we have to provide water, food to various communities in need. It's been a great effort by everyone involved, getting everything that needed to all these communities and making sure everyone, especially our workers out there and our contractors, maintaining their operational efficiency at all times as well, so they're not just out there and not being able to get as much work done. Now as we're into more phase three here, like I was saying, now that we have the more snow and more frozen ground, we're able to move a lot more materials out of these communities, and now we're able to transition more into a pile driving board road repair phase of this work. Early on, these last few weeks, we've been able to move for the snow machines and the piston bully snowcats. We've been able to move about 500,000 pounds a week to various communities in the region. We're ramping up now that our access routes have improved and bringing more piston bullies online. Our goal, and we should be hitting it by, I don't know if it'll be end this week, but early next week, of roughly about 1,000,000 pounds a week of materials that we're moving to these communities. We have roughly 2 months before spring thaw starts hitting where we're not going to be able to use our overland transport units anymore. So it's critical for us over these next 2 months to get as much material to these communities in need as possible. So to date, we've gotten, over 500 helical piles driven. Our production rates for that are going up drastically. We're working 24 hours a day. Contractors working double shifts, 7 days a week, have been for 4 months now. We've moved, 50 homes back in place. The home moving efforts have to do that while the ground is frozen in order to put those homes. Many of them have been displaced almost 4 miles due to the storm surge. We have to put those on skids, use a dozer to drag them back. And that's been critical for a lot of community members to give them a place to go back to once our work is done. We have 170 homes substantially complete, another 160 in progress, 14 communities that are mostly complete, another 15 that we're actively working on right now. We're planning on staying busy as long as we can, doing as much as work as we can, for lack of a better term, keeping our foot on the gas as much as we can. We have a lot of great momentum right now with our contractors and our local hires, and we want to keep that momentum going.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, as many know, I'm from Nome, and I can see Caltag is on here, which is part of the northern route for the Iditarod. So I know these communities are very thankful for all the work that you've done as they prepare to welcome those mushers. I'm curious about the materials that have been expended or that are waste. Just recently building a home, I know how much product that is left after the fact. And so I'm curious on the backhaul. If you could actually just follow up with us of how much material have you backhauled out of communities to keep that from filling their unmanned and unmanaged landfills?
Yep. For the record, this is Merle Senna, through the chair, Senator Tobin. We have a contractor on staff, it's Delta Backhaul, and they've been out in the various communities and they're actually getting rid of waste. They have air burners, they have appliance crushers, we've been doing burning of material. We're stockpiling material there at the barge landing areas so that once, you know, when the rivers do thaw, we're able to barge a bunch of the material out so that we don't leave, you know, all this debris, not just from the reef from our construction, but also a bunch of the debris that was generated from the disaster so it doesn't totally overwhelm their landfill facilities there in these communities.
Senator.
Thank you. I'd love to know the poundage. It would just be a personal interest.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I don't have that exact poundage right now. And then depending on if we're burning it, but we will have a rough order quantity here later this spring once we actually have quantities there stockpiled at the barge landings. So we'll get that to the committee.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here. I think when I total up completed and underway on this slide, it's 28, 27. I was skimming, but I think more than 50 impacted communities. Are there some communities who aren't getting help yet? Do we still need to get help out to them for community repairs? Were they not impacted enough to need repairs? What's the delta there?
Yeah, for the record, Catherine Keith, through the chair, Senator Keel. Yes, there are still communities that need additional resources and support. Some of the communities that had damage even to roadways, by that point, there was enough frozen ground that we weren't able to complete those repairs. So certainly there is going to be ongoing work. The State Emergency Operations Center did a lot of outreach to ensure that those communities applied for public assistance through the FEMA public assistance grant portal. And through that, as they get their grants in place, I think that work will be able to continue.
Hello. Senator Keel.
Thank you. That's helpful. And for those who aren't familiar, who've been fortunate enough not to have disasters, the public assistance is something we think of as individuals, but really it's public infrastructure assistance. It's a federal term. I know you didn't write it. That might be why it's confusing. Do you know, are you familiar with, are those other communities who are not yet in the public assistance repairs queue, are folks getting individual assistance out there yet?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Keel. Yeah, thanks for the clarification on public assistance versus individual assistance. Public assistance is absolutely addressing community-wide impacts, but it can also address even residential impacts when their emergency stabilization level of effort. So in those communities that did not yet get their infrastructure repairs completed, those homeowners should have, assuming eligibility, received individual assistance, and that would be through FEMA. And they do have a good list of those recipients, but it is because of that ability to see firsthand every single home that is impacted. It allows the before and after of those homes. It makes it a very simple application process and verification process for FEMA to then give them the full reimbursement possible for individual assistance.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Merle, for the record, one moment. Oh, just I need to make an announcement. We were joined by Senator Rauscher at 2:20 p.m. Please continue.
Thank you. For the record, this is Merle Senna. For our housing stabilization relocation efforts, like I was saying before, much of this work is pretty climate or pretty impacted by when we can do it. Moving these houses is basically, we can only do that as the ground is frozen. As you can see in this photo here, it's actually a screenshot that I took of a video. We have to take these homes, put them up on skids, and then drag them back to their protective locations. some of these have been in excess of 3 miles, nearly 4 miles. As part of when we were originally going out to the communities of Kipnuk and Quigg, it was very eye-opening. As we were flying in the helicopters, you would see houses roughly 4 miles out of town. And initially, I thought those were like hunting camps or fish camps. And then, but you would see that there's no trails around them whatsoever. Then once we landed, and they were working with the National Guard and working with the community members there who were about to get evacuated, then they were letting us know that those were actually their houses that the storm surge had then moved nearly 4 miles inland. So it was very eye-opening. And so it's been great now that the ground is frozen, now that we have equipment in place, that we're actually able to find these houses, get them and bring them back to the community, to give people a place to live again once they, when they come back.
For the record, Amber Schumpert. It was asked earlier about housing repairs, right? What gives us possibly the authority to do this? Under FEMA, their temporary housing assistance when we have evacuees, their plan doesn't work in Alaska. So we needed an Alaska solution for an Alaska problem. And we worked with the SCOC and with FEMA to get approval for these exigent home repairs. Well-known part of disaster psychology is the quicker you can get displaced people home, the better their outcome psychologically and fiscally throughout their entire life is going to be much better. So that's always been our goal, is to repair as many homes as possible to a baseline, safe, habitable condition, so that way they can then return to their communities if that's what they wish.
For the record, this is Merle Senna. Here's the community of Kipnuk. Kipnuk was probably the most impacted community by this storm. When we came into this community, sort of our methodology, initially when we came in, there was large cracking in the runway, and that was really important for us to get the runway back opened up, because during the initial response, the only way that the National Guard was able to come in and take evacuees out and bring supplies in was due with both Chinooks and Black Hawk helicopters. So it was critical for us in the early part of this disaster to get the runway reopened so that we could bring in fixed wing aircraft so that they could evacuate community members out, along with bringing in critical life and safety supplies in. There was many loads of water, warm clothes, food, various supplies that people were needing as, sort of prioritizing the evacuees. Once we actually got our contractors into these communities, then it was time for us to get to work on building things back. Sort of our methodology of where we sort of allocated our resources was we sort of focused on critical infrastructure routes through all of the different public works facilities there in town. There in Kipnuk, for example, basically the one remaining building was basically the school. In a lot of these communities, the school is the main community center for many of these communities. The school was acting as the emergency shelter for the community. It was acting for our housing, for all the workers. It was basically our operations center there in Kipnuk. The power was going out there in the school because it was running off its own power generator because the power plant had gone down. It has its own water and wastewater treatment system. Both of those were down. So our critical sort of path was to get the school back up and running. Once the school is back up and running, then we could sort of work our way away from the school, rebuilding the critical infrastructure routes, the boardwalk routes, to the power plant, to the washateria, to the water treatment plant, to the fresh water source, to the wastewater treatment, to the landfill, to the barge landing, along with to the various residential areas in the community, along with the access to the airport. One of the favorable qualities of Kipnuk is that the runway is actually 3,000 feet long. That enabled us to actually land C-130s directly into Kipnuk, which logistically has been a huge benefit for our entire operation there, because normally all of our supplies, we fly them into Bethel, then they go out of Bethel to wherever they need to go. Kipnuk, we could actually land C-130s directly there. We even had C-130s going directly from Seattle, landing in Kipnuk with all the supplies. So that has been a big win for us there in Kipnuk, and the amount of work that we've been able to get done in a relatively short amount of time. Again, we have roughly two and a half months left before spring thaw will make it harder for us to get much more work done. All these communities are low-lying marshy areas. Once things start softening up in the spring thaw, it's going to make it very hard to get a lot of this work done. So we're trying to utilize as much of the frozen ground as we can right now to get as much board road repaired, as many houses moved back, as many of these critical lines of, you know, water lines, wastewater lines, and get all these reestablished before spring, along with power lines. The power grid was basically wiped out entirely throughout the community. So we were able to establish getting, you know, over 70 transformers and power poles put back up and get the entire power grid reestablished there in Kipnik, which is great for the community there. Quigg was a little bit different. Quigg, the way it's set up, when the event hit Quigg, basically the entire east side of the town got really isolated from the rest, from the airport and from the school. The board roads and the bridges between the east side of town and the southeast side of town were essentially totally wiped out. And basically all the houses there on the east side and the southeast side all got displaced, pushed on the other side of the river. So we weren't able to, and along with a whole bunch of equipment for their power system. So we, using helicopters, we were able to airlift a bunch of the connexes, a bunch of the power grid materials and supplies, get that back to get the power plant set back up. But we haven't been able to move all the houses back until the river froze, until the ground froze. So we've been focusing on that this last month, and we've making a lot of progress there. Other issues in Quigg. I know it doesn't necessarily look it in the photo, but Quigg has a relatively short runway. So all of the supplies that we've been having to fly into Quigg have been done in smaller aircraft. Not necessarily the most efficient way to go about it. So Quigg has been basically our number one priority for, now that we have the Piston Bully snowcats up and running these last few weeks, Quigg has been our number one route for getting as much supplies there into Quigg as possible for the last couple weeks, and for these next, possibly next 2 months. The school in Quigg has been the other sort of challenge. The school in Quigg has been, again, basically the community center there. That's where all the housing for the workers, for the residents there in Quigg. The school there got a lot of damage during the storm. The water system, freshwater system, heavily damaged. The wastewater and sewer system there at the school, heavily damaged. Power system, fire suppression system. So that's been an ongoing effort to keep the school up and running, to provide a safe and, you know, and for morale, conducive area for our workers, along with the community members, to stay there and be productive and have a good place for everyone to keep on working and get as much work done there as possible for these next couple months. Then in Nightmute, well, even though it is a relatively smaller community compared to Kipnuk and Quigg, Nightmute was a little bit different generally in the scope and what it all entailed. Their landfill was heavily compromised during the storm. So we actually had to go and build, working with DEC, we were able to build a new landfill there, which is a really big win for the community, and also so that we didn't totally overwhelm their existing landfill. There's not as many houses there in Nightmute, but relative to the other communities, a large number of the houses there sustained heavy damage. So as you can see there in that photo, doing a lot of structural repairs to the houses, whether to the subfloor, to the foundations, to the insulation, to a lot of work in the residences there, moving houses there. Work maintaining the road. You can see there in the green line, it's roughly a mile-long road from the community to the airport. That road heavily damaged during the storm, so we were able to reestablish that road to the airport. So Nightmute, even though it was a relatively smaller community, the actual scope and the number of challenges that we had to face there were pretty great. So it was a big win for the community, and along with a great help with our contractors and the local hires there to get as much work done as we can in these last few months.
For the record, Amber Schumpert, Emergency contracting during a disaster, it's not about improvisation. It's executed within defined statutory framework. So all of our contracts were conducted under the governor's disaster declaration, emergency procurement statutes, state procurement code, and in coordination with the Stafford Act. So again, every contract that we issued, every task order and work order that was issued during this event was grounded in statutory authority.
Senator Rauscher has a question.
Yes, thank you to the chair. I was just wondering, do you know how many contractors you have on this entire project?
Yeah, for the record, Catherine Keith through the chair, Senator Rauscher, we've had over 15 prime contractors, and we say over 15 because they've had certainly some substantially sized contractors that are subs to those primes. Right now, we have 9 active prime contractors, and then they each have several subcontractors, whether that's for providing catering or to provide electrical support. So right now, there are 9 active contractors.
Senator Rauscher.
So were a lot of them local, within the state? Or were all of them were local and within the state?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Rauscher. Yes, all of them are in-state contractors.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Anything further on this slide?
No, sir.
I have a couple of questions on this slide. Right after the storm hit and had passed, and there were kind of wide calls for help. And many people across Alaska wanted to help, providing all various types of work, housing, a number of businesses on the Kenai Peninsula, for instance, that offer some type of housing that could be quickly mobilized and then transported to Western Alaska. Some of those folks contacted me and expressed interest in providing some of those services. In a situation like this, what does DOT do to go out and identify people who are interested in providing those kinds of services? And then how do you kind of compare offers? Is there like a competitive process? How do those things work?
Yeah, Chair Bjorkman, and for the record, Catherine Keith, there's several different approaches that we take. The first lens would be who's in the area immediately. Some of the contractors, like Kanik, was already working in one community. And so then, we were identifying through our staff these clusters of communities that needed perhaps similar work types. And then what we would do is we'd issue this temporary work authorization, which would then enable Kanik to begin doing this work and then fleshing out the scopes with our engineers. But then after that, we've put out other calls through like the Association of General Contractors, AGC. We asked them to put out the message for, any contractors that were still mobilized and able to provide support. Certainly there are several contractors that there is done for the year. And then some may have been done, but they were willing and able to go back into a community to do further repairs. So, and then beyond that, we did have folks reach out to us that we typically haven't worked with before, and usually it's by email or through word of mouth. We also have our website that we keep open for the storm, for Typhoon Halong, and we would get inquiries that way that would get passed through us. When someone does reach out, what we ask for is a list of capabilities, what equipment they have, what their availability is, and then we would deploy them accordingly. I mean, the need was so vast here. We were certainly taking advantage of folks that were able to operate. As we move forward with them and we initiate this work authorization, our staff begin going through and looking at rates, what equipment they have, and work on the schedule to get them in the field and identifying the work that they would be doing. For all of these contracts, as we get underway, they're all time and materials contracts. Because the scope was quite vague, we would have, one company go out to work on board roads, but then they would end up perhaps providing food services, or they're working on, trying to correct raw water line. So because of that, the time and materials component of this was essential. That being said, as we move forward, we're doing everything we can to identify unit pricing on some of these items. So back to your question, it's typically just through direct reaching out to the department. And then from there, we initiate conversation as able.
Thank you. Senator Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you again. I appreciate it through the chair. So being out there in the middle of nowhere, you know, I mean, relatively, who is making sure the work is done correctly?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Rauscher, we have our construction administrator staff, so project engineers and our inspectors. We've had a base in Bethel since the event first launched our effort. I would say starting mid-October, we had a base there. And so we've rotated in staff that, you know, typically they're working in the summer, but a lot of staff wanted to support this effort. So then they came back throughout this winter to be available. And so they're there on site. Right now we have, for example, in Quiguilinoc and Kipnick, we have one person that's staying in the community every day. Then we have inspectors that are in Bethel, and they'll go out to on site every day or two, depending on what active work is happening at the time. And then beyond that, we have significant reporting that's expected of the contractors, the type of work that they're doing. And then we go in and capture photos, and depending on the scope of work, we capture that with our own daily reports, all of which is required for FEMA as we go through and request reimbursement. Want to add anything, Merle? Mm-hmm.
For the record, this is Merle Senna through the chair, Senator Rush. And then also in NOAATAC, we have DOT employees there with NOAATAC and crews doing work in NOAATAC. It's sort of depending on every community and what the needs are for that contractor in that community will sort of dictates on if we have one of our employees staying out there full time or if we sort of have them on rotation, you know, depending on aircraft availability and weather, we'll go and we'll try and hit a number of different communities in a single day. In Bethel right now, we have a number of communities that are accessible via the ice roads or via snow machine right now. So we have a number of our staff traveling via snow machine and ice road every day out to various communities outside of the Bethel area as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Just so we can maintain concurrent inspection at all times to make sure that all the work is being done in accordance with our standards, as well as making sure that we're meeting our, you know, making sure that we have all of our documentation for our FEMA reimbursement process.
Very nice. Thank you.
Please continue.
All right, for the record, Amber Schumpert, your term objectives for the next 30 to 60 days, as we've touched on several times, it's all about this seasonal window. As winter deteriorates, it's going to make some of our tasks difficult, if not plain out impossible. So we have to maximize this winter construction window to complete those pile supported boardwalks, stabilize public facilities, and finalize relocations. At the same time, our compliance controls are fully in operation. We are documenting ICS finance tracking, early eligibility requirements aligned with SCOC and with FEMA. Our documentation is tied directly to FEMA categories. So we're not completing documentation or having to reconstruct it after the fact. We're completing it as we go. And that's going to be really helpful to protect us against audit when it does come time for reimbursement. We're advancing recovery while protecting the state's fiscal position. Throughout this event, again, it's all tied to the documentation. We started it the correct way, and we're going to see it through to the end the correct way. This storm, it tested our systems. In the next phase, it's about strengthening them so that before this next winter shift or the spring shift comes again. So work is continuing, but it's continuing with structure and with accountability.
Thank you, Ms. Schumpert. Questions on this item? I have a question. It's kind of a hypothetical, and I don't understand. But every once in a while, folks send me some concerns, right? So let's just say you have this company who provides a service, And they often are a subcontractor to maybe a larger company who can provide a collection of services. But that smaller company might want to compete with the bigger company to provide service A. In a situation like this, is there a process for them to do that? I've heard, you know, one company might say to their little brother company, hey, don't try to do this or we'll not hire you as a sub in the future. Like, how do you handle something like that? If you were to, like, become aware of something like that, how would DOT handle that type of activity that is probably not in the public interest as far as cost or, like, competitiveness in the future? How would you go about handling something like that if you became aware of situations like that?
Yeah, through the chair, Chair Bjorkman, for the record, Catherine Keith, there's a couple things that come to mind as individual contractors reach out to us. I do want to say some of our contractors have never worked with the DOT before, and there was a very steep learning curve to understand our processes and the paperwork that we need and certified payroll and everything that comes with contracting with the state. But I would say that's one way that we manage that. If it is a subcontractor that perhaps hasn't served as that prime interface with the department, a lot of it is through education and taking time to work with contractors, especially smaller contractors, which are absolutely critical to having a diverse response. Regardless of, you know, when we talk about cost competitiveness, we have pretty strict protocols that we have to follow for our specifications when we're in a time and materials contract. Certified payroll follows pamphlet 600, so these rates are common. Same thing with equipment. We follow equipment watch rates where possible unless there's justification beyond that. So it becomes, you know, less of a concern of cost competitiveness and just more about transparent documentation and being able to do the work, have resources, staff, equipment, the ability to navigate complex disaster response. And, you know, that's what we're seeing right now, or the contractors that we have left are certainly standing out for the ability to work in a challenging environment as a team. The contractors are having to very much work together, shared equipment, common work areas and environments, just working on, you know, who has the skills to do what. So I think both of those, the education of contractors not necessarily familiar with DOT and the way that our time and materials are set up, it does level the playing field.
Very good. Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity again, Chair. So the picture that we're looking at right now, okay, it basically you're skidding, right? So is that easy right now in the middle of the winter to get materials to all the locations that you have to get them to? And is it easier than it appears to me, or is it more cumbersome than I could even imagine?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Rauscher, I would say it's more cumbersome than can be imagined. The logistics of this, when you consider 8 million pounds, that is an incredible amount of material, especially when you consider it's not all dense. Some of it would be insulation. What we're looking at here is a piston bully, and right now we have six of them in Bethel. We're likely going to get two more. And they needed to have about 2 feet of ice, and so we had to wait for a certain time of year, and then we were ensuring that we have that level of thickness. We also needed snow, so we could pack down the snow and make solid enough trails. So I would say every day, you know, we are meeting in the morning. We have operational briefings, looking at the weather, looking at what we need to have go where, and then what's the best mechanism of travel, whether it's a Beaver that's landing in Quiguilinoc, or if it's an A-Star helicopter that's bringing critical supplies out to Kipnuk. We're trying to, you know, we had a table up earlier that had the cost per pound per hour of these different transport mechanisms. So we take that into consideration. But we've had all all sorts of materials being sent out, fuel tanks, generators, plywood, massive insulation, foam board. Our procurement office, which is actually our statewide equipment fleet here in town, our acquisition firm, you know, they often joke, but they have a running list of how many days has gone by since they've acquired something that they've never had to acquire before. It could be pipe, just ATVs, you know, on and on and on. So the logistics has been very challenging, especially on the tracking side, keeping inventory of all of these items, because we do need to account for everything that we purchase and where it goes and what it's used for. So when you look at the wide variety of suppliers, it has been a pretty incredible data tracking effort, which all of our staff are contributing to in this open source platform. And some of the materials, at one point we bought out Anchorage of, you know, something like CDX plywood. If anyone was trying to do home construction in November, you probably noticed it. Insulation, we had to start shipping up from Seattle because it wasn't available in state. So sorting out where to get things from and getting it out to a remote location with sometimes very limited airport access is an issue. To build up these board roads to the standard that, you know, we had among several different entities determined. We have a board road standard that we're building these back to. They need these 3-inch by 12-inch by 20-foot long, you know, pressure-treated lumber. And it's not a common thing, and usually these take a long lead item of like 6 to 9 months to be able to get them for a project. So we scoured the different companies that made these across the U.S. We couldn't find any that were available, so then we had to go to Canada to look at the lumber mills there that could produce these and have them available in this time. But then we need to sort out how we get things from Canada into Alaska and the requirements of the state along with that. So it has been a very interesting process, and but I think we're seeing it now with the potential that these piston bullies have, along with, you know, we have over 45 snow machines out right now driving cargo all over to Tuntutuliak and Congiganak and across to Kipnuk, soon to Kipnuk. And they can haul over 100,000 pounds in a day. It's absolutely incredible. So we're seeing, especially through this locally driven effort, that, you know, we think we're going to get the materials out that are needed this spring.
Interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Commissioner, this is a tremendous effort, and you've heard me say it before, but I'll say it again. I applaud the administration for putting a bunch of folks at DOT on this work, and I'm glad they're doing it, and it's remarkable how much they're doing. All of these folks had full-time jobs doing state stuff before the storm hit. And I know we chatted a little bit in December about what the impacts would be on DOT's capacity. We weren't in session in December. We couldn't give you a bunch of backfill money to add people. But you have, as you mentioned, your state equipment fleet folks doing a lot of this procurement, and Mr. Cena's got engineering work and other operations management stuff and so on and so forth throughout the department. How are we looking now for impacts on the other work of the department? Not to minimize the importance of this, because it's the right thing to do. How about the other stuff too? Where are we?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's actively under discussion right now. So in my role as acting central region director, you know, I am there in the building. Most of the staff that are now responding, with the exception of NOAA-TAC, are all central region staff, our pre-construction crew, our construction leads. So we're looking at staffing over the next couple months to ensure that, you know, those project engineers that are required for very critical projects this spring, that they're able to do that work. Boy, they're certainly challenged, though. It's a lot of work. And that part, it's been inspiring with what our staff are doing every day, 7:30 in the morning. They're taking these calls since October. I think we're all getting to know each other pretty well. And we're trying to just be very honest with each other when they are starting to have that work overload or things are starting to slip. And then we do kind of accommodate that by getting them the resources that they need. But perhaps Merle could comment a little bit further on that, having that day-to-day engagement with our on-the-ground staff.
Again, this is Merle Senna through the chair, Senator Keel. Being the Bethel operations manager and having, at the early part of this disaster, we had just in the bunkhouse we were at, we had 18 guys and 4-bedroom bunkhouse, and not to mention just every available room all across Bethel booked in Nome, Kotzebue. Right in the early goings, I think we had almost 100 people deployed out in the field at the very beginning. Now, as we've gone into more of the construction phase of this, it's a challenge making sure that all the guys that we have out there in the field are in a good place mentally, emotionally, and physically. Typically for us in construction, the winter time is normally our time, the last day of construction season, from, April till, call it November. This happened right at the end of our construction season. So we actually did have availability for our construction staff that were able to immediately jump into this, and it's been an amazing effort by all of the folks throughout all various departments, various divisions. It's been amazing to see. I've been with the state for 23 years, and this has been by far the most amazing group effort across divisions, departments that I've been part of. But as part of that, as we're getting closer into the springtime and upcoming construction season, through Deputy Commissioner Keith and through our other management, constant contact with them on letting them know what our needs are, letting them know what our staff level, being able to gauge that accordingly with what our work level is, where our contractors have going, as we're starting to sort of bring down the number of sites, number of communities that we're working on as we're approaching the springtime, where we're going to be going down to basically our main communities of Kipnuk, Quigg, Kong. So it sort of is working out, at least right now in the middle of February, it's working out well that as our workload is starting to taper down a little bit, it's really hot and heavy right now. But actually for our in boots on the ground level stuff, it should be tapering down as our other work starts to ramp up again. So that'll just be being in constant contact with Deputy Commissioner Keith and our other management, making sure that we're relaying those needs to them. But I don't feel that there shouldn't be minimal impact on where our operational capacity is moving forward.
Yeah, and for the record, Catherine Keith, I would say in addition to our construction staff, there's also a significant burden on other parts of the department, our procurement, our contracts, our finance staff. Right now, it's hundreds of invoices, each week that come in from different vendors, suppliers, air carriers. We need to go all through all of these and code them, get them processed. And these are staff that have to do the same thing across all of the departments. So those types of support services are also, feeling a bit more stressed right now. So we're just applying that same methodology as where they are getting backed up. We have to figure out where to bring in resources. And it is, in fact, the model that we're looking at. This isn't a reorganization topic, but having the ability to support these ICS functions when we do need to have them requires people from, all over to jump in. Using Eli Kessen Brackett as an example, our legislative liaison, he jumped right out to go out into the field and help do assessments on houses and bridges and whatever else. So we're just needing to change whatever our title is. People are just kind of jumping in and sorting out what needs to be done. But it is a risk delaying projects and other things this spring. So we're just approaching it with that awareness and then being active about mitigating where we see any impacts.
Thank you. I have another question relating to FEMA reimbursement and our ability to recover costs. I'll try to break this out, and maybe if you could just – I don't want to ask like five questions at once, so one at a time. We had some discussion in earlier committee work in different committees about communication that came out originally for the disaster request and what reimbursement would be from the federal government. And there was talk that it would be 100%, and now we've heard it's lower. Do you have any update as to how much of this cost will be borne by the federal government and the state government? Is there any update to that percentage?
Yeah, Chair Bjorkman, and for the record, Catherine Keith, the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs is leading that discussion with FEMA at present. So I don't have an update, but we're eagerly looking forward to that as well.
Yeah. Thank you. I think many people would be surprised to learn that under state government structures and processes, with the housing situation and having that Alaska tailored and unique response that we did for housing, that our state government together with our federal partners would be responsible for repairing individual homes and purchasing things like snow machines and four-wheelers. Do we have clear guidance with like stone cold lead pipe lock guarantees that all of these things are going to be reimbursed? Are we good there? What's our risk profile like?
Yeah, Chair Bjorkman, I'm going to answer the first part of that and hand it over to Amber Shumpert for her input. The key is documentation. Without proper documentation and very, very thorough documentation, we are at high risk of not getting reimbursed. So that's why you're seeing a significant, you know, innovative push to fully document it so there isn't any question as to whether or not it was eligible, and then the cost associated with that. We will be working on reimbursement for years to come based on prior experience, but we are hoping, because of the way that we worked with FEMA so differently this time, because they were, again, firsthand with us on that common operating picture, which hadn't happened before. So we have much higher confidence than we usually do going through these that we'll have that full reimbursement. And you want to talk about housing repairs?
Yes. Yeah. For the record, Amber Shumpert, Chair Bjorkman. So as Deputy Commissioner Keith mentioned, having FEMA literally in the room with us, having them in the SCOC from the very beginning, all of the resource requests that we and all of our partners submitted were run through not only state public assistance officials, but also FEMA public assistance to ensure that they were in alignment with the requirements of the Stafford Act. So when they approved a 213 for us to, you know, purchase snow machines for the response efforts, they weren't for, you know, individuals, it was for the response. So they are state property and response property. There'll be disposition at a future date to determine how those are handled. But for now, those were absolutely in alignment with required purchases and should be reimbursable. You know, PACE audit will come with when that time comes. But for housing, FEMA does allow exigent repairs. That's under normal emergency stabilization, not even taking into account the special concessions they're allowing us as Alaskans. But FEMA allows for that emergency stabilization to ensure that the homes do not continue to face more damage, and that they meet that basic habitability standard. So that's standard disaster response protocol.
Very good. Thank you. Well, I know that many of you have worked long and hard on this response. I appreciate greatly all of your efforts and the amount of time it's taken to do all of these things, in addition to the many things that you have to do in your normal jobs. So thank you all very much. Many times here, having committee meetings and doing the things that we do, we have to ask hard questions and maybe have difficult conversations. But I want you all to know that I appreciate you, and the people of our state appreciate you too, and the work that you do and the long hours that you put in. And certainly I can only imagine it's probably not the most fun to spend your weekends getting ready for committee meetings, and then during the week you have like irregular jobs to do, and then like these annoying legislators keep asking you questions. It's an interesting thing that we all do here in this public process, and I appreciate the work that you do to provide information to us and the public about the stuff that you have all done here. It's something to be celebrated, and we all want to support you and make sure that Alaskans are taken care of. I want to close today's meeting by just reading some feedback that I got from a local stakeholder involved with the coastal villages out there, and reached out to folks to get some feedback, and here's what they shared. They said, "These folks are absolute rock stars. Deputy Commissioner Keith and her team led the most timely, comprehensive, and effective state of Alaska disaster response I've ever seen. They had drone teams on the ground as fast as we did, with many more operators and drones, and had a whole damage assessment deployment plan in place that they executed at a regional level. They followed through with imagery analysis tools and a mapping team. Then they put boots on the ground to visit our communities and make massive contributions toward physical recovery. I couldn't say enough good stuff about them. I would venture to say that they transformed my perception of state emergency response." It's a good job. Okay. That concludes our meeting for today. Unless you had other stuff that you wanted to share.
No, thank you to the committee for this opportunity to speak to the response.
You're welcome. Okay. The Senate Transportation Committee will meet again on Thursday when we will discuss pedestrian safety in Anchorage with the Municipality of Anchorage, the Anchorage Police Department, and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. As there is no further business to come before the committee at this time, we are adjourned at 3:03 p.m.